Hey, everybody. Welcome to Somebody's Blues, Episode 2. I'm your host, Eric McKelvin, Festival Director of the New York State Blues Festival. This is a new podcast series that is setting out to explore the history of blues in Central New York, in our region and beyond, and in general to have an open and diverse conversation about this great American art form. Joining me today is singer, songwriter, and harmonicist extraordinaire, Pete McMahon. Pete is, of course, known for his work with the legendary Syracuse-based group, the Kingsnakes, as well as John Lee Hooker, Savoy Brown, and his own Pete McMahon and the Supernaturals. Hi, Pete. Thanks for joining us on Somebody's Blues.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it. Like we were just saying earlier, you know, I'm looking out the window here. What is it, December 29th? A little bit of a snowstorm in the middle of a pandemic, just after the holidays, and we're in this crazy time we're living in, huh? So this is a good thing to do, talk about the blues.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, and who knows when we're going to be able to really be back out and getting down in person. We'll spend the time. It's like everybody's woodshed time, right?
There you go.
Get better at your instrument, get better at your presentation, you know, and for those in the audience, they can, you know, learn and study about all the great stuff going on in the world. So,
sure.
Well, yeah, one of the things that, you know, we were just chatting about is how, you know, we're trying to share some of the information about how blues got started in Syracuse and how that scene got developed and how some of the early bands got together. So why don't you go ahead and give us, how did it start for you and what were your first musical experiences and how did all that go?
Yeah, my story is probably similar to a lot of people that become kind of like blues musicians or whatever you want to call it. But like, I think when I was like 11 years old, used to like hop cars in the neighborhood, you know, on snowy days like this, where our friends would go up. There was this corner store called Maloney's. I lived up by Onondaga Park on the southwest side of Syracuse. And we were hopping cars, I think, and there was some older hippies in the neighborhood that used to hang out and smoke weed on the corners or whatever. And I think one of them lost a harmonica, you know, it dropped on the corner. And just back in the days, like, you know, like when Bob Dylan probably made the harmonica kind of famous back, you know, late 60s, that kind of thing. And I remember finding that it was like squished, like called like the tin sandwich, but it was like squished, you know what I mean? From somebody like sitting on it or whatever. But I remember playing it and I can't remember how long I had it, but I ended up losing it too. So that was a wandering harmonica. And so I played a little bit, but I remember seeing, you know, people in the neighborhood, little here and there walking home from school or something. Like I said, that was more like the Bob Dylan kind of thing back then, you know. Then when I was, I think when I was 12, I got a harmonica from my sister in like a stocking, you know, that they hang on the fireplace thing. And I remember grabbing it and going up in our attic. We had like a live-in attic because we had 8 kids in our family. I went up there and I played for like a couple of hours. I think, you know, really had kind of an experience, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just relating with the instrument. And the rest is history from there. You know, I just really like got glued to the harmonica. And one thing, like I remember I was thinking to myself, what am I going to try to talk about in this thing? And I remember like my first time kind of experiencing the 1-4-5 thing that they talk about in blues, you know, the kind of progression, you know, whether you do it fast or for a slow blues, but it's the same thing, that 1-4-5 key progression. I remember my brother Paul, who's like 14 years older than me, he passed away, but he had this like a lot of music in my house too, you know, with a bunch of sisters and all that, 45s and all that kind of thing. But I remember hearing this one song called Blues Theme. It's like a biker kind of song. You have to look it up. And that's, I remember hearing that. I would go into his room like and listen to that when I was hearing it. It's like something about it, you know what I mean? Hearing that 1-4-5. And this is probably when I was like 8 or 9 years old or something, you know what I mean? But that's kind of my first, you get that goosebumps kind of thing, you know what I mean? Or something kind of reaches you like that. But my other brother, Joe, who's like 7 years older than me, we used to sleep in the attic and share a room. And he was kind of a, you know, a little bit of a latter-day hippie kind of, you know, partier kind of thing. And he would come in, he had an 8-track player in the room, and he would come in from being out, you know, late at night, and I would already be half asleep, and he'd put in like, you know, a John Mayall 8-track or a Jay Giles or Allman Brothers. It was that kind of thing, you know what I mean? And he'd pass out, and then I'd be like wide awake listening to the music, you know, I'm a younger guy, you know, and the 8-tracks, they just keep playing, you know what I mean? Like it just never stops, you know? So he'd fall asleep and I would hear this stuff and it would just like hardwired into my brain, you know? And so I'd had the harmonica by then and this stuff was just like getting ingrained in me, you know? And my next door neighbor, Tommy English, and you know, they had a lot of good music. And I remember growing up here in Savoy Brown and there when they'd be in their room with the cool guys, you know, with their cowboy boots and blue jeans, long hat, you know? Yeah. Jean jacket kind of thing. So like, I remember when I first got asked to join Savoy Brown, I was like, wow, what a trip, you know, that from like being a young teenager and hearing that stuff and being like, that's what is like really cool. You know what I mean? Then you become part of something like that. So it's just it's a fun road that you travel to.
Sure. So what, that early 70s Savoy Brown stuff was, I had some older buddies who played in a band that were into that, you know, Too Tall to Mambo and all this stuff. And, you know, it was like, it's funny, like it hasn't, it's one of those things, I feel like some of that stuff is a little bit lost to like classic rock fans out there, that maybe it doesn't have as much of an audience as it should, because it's really fun. That early 70s era was just such a fun blend of really when, you know, rock music still had some role in it or whatever, you know what I mean? There was that.
Yeah, there's a lot of blues influence in like bands like Savoy Brown. So that's why it was cool to me.
And sure.
You know what I mean? A big part of the, you know, that's like a essence of the band. That's why that music had like, you know, substance and soul to it.
Yeah, well, and it's, there's a funness, I think, that unfortunately rock music after that time period started to lose, where things became more just the rock, the simpler beat and the crunchier guitars. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just a matter of that the other things sort of went away for a little while and then it ended up making a gigantic comeback in the 80s with the whole blues explosion across the country with SRV and Thorogood and all that stuff. And
definitely
the other great things coming, you know, up as well. But what was so when you got into how'd you get into playing with other people, and what was the what were your first band experiences?
I would, like, the cool thing about me with the harmonica is like when I was, you know, really early teenage years, there wasn't a lot of like band. I wasn't playing with bands and stuff. I was just playing, like, I would play when I was out with my friends and, you know, like solo, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you try to get things going and the people get, you know, kicking their feet and stuff. So that was, it was really good.
That's cool.
Exercise.
Sure. Like,
and there was a couple friends in the general neighborhood that played, my friend Tom Murphy and this guy Paul Epic. And we would have like jam sessions just with the harmonica, you know what I mean? And try to, like, you know, exchange ideas and all these things, and you're developing and evolving and learning the instrument. Then I think actually like the first music that I was playing was with this guy. He was young back then. He's like 2 years younger than I am. And I was like, say, 14, 15. He was 12 and 13, but he was like a prodigy on bass guitar, Mike Schafter. And I actually ended up working with him later. He had a tree trimming service. And I did some of that stuff in the late 90s with him. But he was big into Jaco Pastorius. You know, like he could really play all that kind of virtuosic bass guitar. But he had a couple friends from the Valley, Bobby Budd and his older brother, Kenny Budd, and Bobby Holtz played drums. So these were like my teenage years. And I remember my first paying gig was doing a Shea Middle School, like graduation party, kind of prom, something like that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I was like 15, like I say, Mike was like 13, and got my first paying, you know, gig. So
yeah,
15 years old.
Yeah, cool. So what? So you know, let's What about, was the King Snakes your first blues group, or were you playing, did you play with a...
No, I had like
groups, a... were you doing blues
stuff? I had like a little bit of evolution. So like I say, I would do that, and we'd play house parties and stuff through the teenage years.
Yeah.
And then I remember Jody Grenier, who lived in that neighborhood too, by down by Mike Schafter's house. He would take me across the street to his buddy's house, Phillips's, who had, they had a piano there, and he played in the Sandy Big Tree band back then.
Okay. And
Terry Mulhauser from the King Snakes, who I ended up with.
Yeah.
This is back, you know, later 70s, mid to late 70s. And he showed me the 1-4-5 that we were talking about earlier on the piano. He'd say, okay, here's, this is like, say, you know, the E chord, you know, you're playing like this, then you go to A, and you know, that kind of thing. So you're doing the 1-4-5. He was trying to explain it, and I actually didn't understand it, you know what I mean, in musical terms, but you could feel it, you know what I mean? You could say, okay, yeah, I'm getting it, there's the change, you know, and so on. So all that kind of stuff was part of my upbringing with it, and understanding of music and stuff. And then let's see, then I got to be playing my later teenage years with like you were talking earlier, you said about Woodshed and that kind of thing. Yeah. Reminded me of this guy, Otis Lee. I played in the Otis Lee Blues Band for a few years off and on. And during that same time, with a guy named Don Zog, who was kind of a legend from the south side of Syracuse, who he was doing Savoy Brown stuff. You should have Terry Mulhauser on here sometime. He can go back further than I can go. You know what I mean? With the
Syracuse. Yeah, I definitely will, yeah.
He was doing Savoy Brown stuff in the late 60s when Savoy Brown was just coming out too, you know what I mean? He was in a band called Scarecrow Jones. But I played with him in D-Zog and the Hellhounds and Otis Lee Blues Band. And they were kind of some rough guys, you know what I mean? We would play some rough places and so on and so forth. So that was good.
Yeah.
You know, experience as far as getting into the blues world, the real thing, you know? And I also played with this guy, Frank Corso, who's like, he does the barrel house blues kind of stuff, you know what I mean? The old, you know, Robert Johnson and so on, with those resonator silver guitars, you know, that have the palm trees on the back and the resonator. And Jody Grenier, who I mentioned earlier, he was in that. We had a thing called the Barrel House Blues Trio that we used to play down at Freddie Pratt's and some different places that was down on South Geddes Street. Late 70s, starting to go into the 80s, and
so let me get into that if I may, in that, to that little era, because now I've asked a lot of people about blues history stuff, and this is the first time that anybody's really talked to me about that scene, about the Southside and about late 70s, early 80s. A lot of people will say Kyle Shirley turned me on to stuff in the early 80s, or it was guys, or so, but this is good stories, because this is where I was like, well, how did it all sort of get to that point? You know, like, you guys had already obviously had some experience by the time you were doing the King Snakes. It wasn't like you just showed up formed like that.
No,
you know?
Exactly.
So, and I don't know, for whatever variety of reasons, I feel like that the Syracuse music history hasn't heard that much about maybe some of these other groups. This is, like I say, these are some newer names to me, maybe everybody, but I wasn't aware of Otis Lee Blues Band, and so
there would have been no King Snakes if there wasn't people like you know, Don Zog, and Otis Lee. They were like doing the real thing, blues, you know.
Okay.
Way before it was cool, you know.
Yeah. What were the audiences like at these places? Was it all a Was it predominantly African-American, or was it mixed?
Mixed, you know, I played all kinds of places with those guys. We play, you know, Central New York area, but just a lot of different funky places. And I remember, like, one time we played a gig up in Central Square with the Otis Lee Blues Band, you know, and predominantly white, you know, country kind of thing. Sure. And people loved us when we were playing and stuff, but as the night was going on, and you know, people were getting their beers going and all that, they ended up being like, they started giving us crap at the end of the night, because, you know, half of the band was African American, and Minnie Lee was there, Otis's wife Minnie Lee, who was a big woman. And you know, we started trying to pack up our stuff really quickly and get out of there. And they were following us out in the parking lot and so on. There was big Rumble. And
oh, jeez.
I think Minnie sliced a couple pieces. She had a thing which she called Quicksilver, you know, like people were walking by, she was just slicing them. And,
jeez.
But that's that, you know, that's the kind of stuff that was like blues boot camp.
Yeah, absolutely.
that laid the foundation for like the Kingsnakes thing, you know. But those guys were the real thing. So it was a good experience to learn the fundamentals of blues music and that kind of lifestyle and stuff.
What's going on? Sure. So did you know Terry then?
Like I say, Terry. It's interesting because what happened then there started to be more like formalized, people were making formalized attempts at doing blues bands. Like there was this band, Triple Shot, which was like late 70s and then into like 1980, I think. And that was Kelly James, you know, Dr. Blue.
Yeah.
Seth Holzman, who's a great harmonica player. I think he's from Philadelphia originally, but he was up here, you know, from a Syracuse University thing and ended up hanging around here and so on. And Henry Brent was on drums and this guy, Joe Cholesky on guitar and Paul Laron on bass guitar, mm-hmm. who ended up being in the Kingsnakes. So all these different avenues, like, you know, came and then that's what made the Kingsnakes, but it was like an evolution, you know,
yeah.
It was the right time, right place, all that kind of thing. But so that's where I first met like Kelly and, great guy. And at the end of the Triple Shot thing, Kelly called me to try to have me resurrect the band because it was kind of fading. I think some of the different people were moving back out of town from being, you know, SU students and so on. And I remember doing a few weeks of rehearsals and stuff, but that thing just dissipated, you know? And so Kelly and I stayed in touch closely for like the next couple of years and made like three different attempts to get what eventually became the Kingsnakes. But we did it one time. It was Too Bad James and the Mississippi Mules. I remember we were opening up for shows at Cannon's Ballroom for like a Chicago blues acts that Kelly or Kyle was bringing in. Mm-hmm. And that had Joe Cholesky from Triple Shot was on guitar. Great. He could really play that guitar parts for like Little Walter stuff and all that. It was killer, you know? And but then that fell apart after a while. I know Joe Cholesky moved. And then there was another band. I forget what it was called, but we opened up for another couple shows at Cannon's Ballroom for, you know, some touring Chicago acts, Eddie Clearwater, a bunch of different people. And, then the third time we tried, he was like, and he called me again, he goes, Pete, okay, I think I got this guy. And he was talking about Terry Mulligan. He goes, I saw this dude last night, man, because he was out scouting, you know, musicians to say who would fit in this band. He saw Terry Mulhauser, I think with the band Axe Handle. This is after Sandy Big Tree Band. And he says, he's just a, you know, a short guy, man, but he just blasts out the blues, you know. And he goes, at the end of the night, I was talking to him, I thought he was blind. Because he plays with his eyes closed, you know. But so that's how that happened. And then one thing led to another, and that, you know, became the incarnation of the Kingsnakes.
Yeah. At first you guys were, Kelly was in the band, or was like Kelly and the Kingsnakes?
It was Dr. Blue and the Kingsnakes for like the first year.
Uh-huh.
And we were doing, you know, different shows around here and there. And then we settled into a place, called Nappy's on the north side. It was an old strip joint that had like mirrors on the back of the stage, you know, and we could, like, they would hang up blankets and stuff to try to say, you know,
yeah.
Otherwise it was strange looking. But so that was a good place for a blues band, right? An old strip joint. It had a good stage and it was a cool place too. It was, you know, just the right size. It wasn't too big, wasn't too small, and it was kind of a lot of padding in there, so the sound was good. And we really evolved there because we were like the house band there. We brought in a lot of national blues acts that we would open up for, and John Hammond came there quite a few times, and we'd open for him, then he'd have us up and back him up towards the end of his set, which was a real privilege, you know.
Yeah.
Really cool stuff going on. It was a really fun time. Like you said earlier, that was the start of the 80s thing, because this was like the earlier 80s, and
yeah,
it went crazy.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. And so then when did the King Snakes, you guys started obviously to get out of the region, like not too long after that, right? You started
it took off, and we were like a, you know, well-rehearsed band. We had a rehearsal studio right around the corner from Nappy's in this old warehouse, this huge couch that went all the way around the outside so we could get comfortable there and play. It was like, you know, second home from home, you know? Mm-hmm. And we rehearsed like every Tuesday and Thursday at least. And then we would play weekends. And then we got so busy that we would have to squeeze in rehearsals because we were playing most every night of the week, you know?
Sure.
It exploded.
Yeah, and then so then you started playing out of state and going down south and stuff, I guess, right?
Yeah, we just started chipping away and then started doing East Coast runs and all kinds. It was a really fun experience. We got to, you know, we basically got to live out our dreams to try to, you know, we were big admirers of like the Fabulous Thunderbirds and the Nighthawks and different bands like that. And then we were out there playing all the places that they were playing, you know?
Right.
Up and down those roads.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. So, as I was saying, I mentioned to you earlier, the first time I saw you guys, I was, I don't know what month it was, whatever. I was 16 or 17. I saw you guys open for B.B. King at an Urban League.
Remember that gig at the Landmark? That was a good gig. And I'll tell you, too, we opened up for him like three times, like once in Buffalo, couple times here, maybe three or four times. But I've talked to other bands too, somebody like B.B. King, who's touring, you know, nonstop, you know, major star, the king of the blues. And he would, every gig where he had a band that would open up for him, he would come into the dressing room of the opening act and shake our hands. Like every gig we did with him, he did, it's like, hi, I'm B.B. King. It's like, whoa, we know who you are. But I mean, what a gentleman, you know? Yeah. To do that. And then after a while, when I got to be on the road like that quite a bit, you realize how gracious that was of him, because you're tired on the road, man. You know, you're traveling, then you're getting, you know, and sometimes you take that time just to kind of rest before you got to go out and do the gig yourself. But it just shows what a gentleman he was, you know, and real dignified emperor of the blues there.
Yeah, very cool. So where's the, how far did you guys where did you guys go out to West Coast at all or anything?
We did, the King Snakes did, if you look at North America and split it right down, like down, you know, the Mississippi and then up the middle of Canada, we did all of that a lot, you know, we zigzagged all over the place. And like the last gig we did with John Lee Hooker was, 1990, he headlined the Chicago Blues Festival, and we were backing him up, and he had all kinds of special guests with him. He had Willie Dixon came out on stage, and
wow, that's awesome.
One of the drummer from Jimi Hendrix's band, I can't remember his name right now, but he sang, you know, Them Changes, that Buddy Miles,
bunch of
people. But it was it was really something.
Yeah, that's awesome. So how did you meet John Lee Hooker, and how did that sort of come about?
The King Snakes opened up for Hooker in 1996 at the Lost Horizon, and I got up the nerve to go back after our show and talk to him, you know, in the dressing room, and I went back there and I just told him, you know, I'm a big fan of his, he's a legend, you know, and mm-hmm. And then I got up the nerve to say, hey, I was wondering if I could possibly sit in, you know, and I was saying, in the spirit of like Al Wilson, you know, he loved Al Wilson from Canned Heat.
Yeah.
There's a real famous album, Hooker and Heat, it's called. It's brilliant. You know, that's killer. That was a huge influence.
Blind Owl.
And the Blind Owl, exactly. And so I was asking, so, you know, in the spirit of Al Wilson, could I sit in with him? He looked at me, his eyes were like, whoa. And then he had this big tour manager at that time named Yogi. He was a big Hawaiian guy. I think he was like 6'7", 320 pounds, you know what I mean? Yeah. And he came back and he's like, well, everybody out of the dress room, you know. I said, well, he was doing his job, you know. I was thinking he's kind of mean at that time, but he's just doing what a road manager is supposed to do, you know.
Sure.
And I remember getting escorted out of there and looking back, and Hooker was looking at me like he felt terrible, you know. Mm-hmm. He couldn't even say anything. He was just like looking at me like I could see he was saying I'm sorry with his eyes, you know. And so I got to talk to him after the gig too, and it was really cool. I remember mentioned him once. I said, hey, John, you do like, you know, these new bands come out? You like the Fabulous Thunderbirds? And he says, you mean Jimmy Ray or Stevie Ray? He was showing me his hip too, you know, all the cats that are out there. But so then, like a week and a half after that gig, I think we were rehearsing over at Paul Aron's apartment there. He lived below his sister. And we got a call from our agency, DMR agency. Mm-hmm. He said, yeah, we just got a call from the West Coast there, San Francisco, John Lee Hooker's booking agent, Rosebud Agency, and said, John's wondering if you would like to back him up on tours when he's, you know, in the eastern half of the United States, you know, North America. We were like, holy cow. Yeah. So obviously that did something, you know what I mean? It registered in his head, and our band name was the Kingsnakes, you know?
Yeah.
And so named after one of his songs, Crawling Kingsnake. So we got to do that for the next 4 years at the top of what we were doing. It was just, you know, phenomenal experience.
Yeah, very cool. So what years were that?
What's that?
What years were you guys doing that?
Oh, so then we got to do the years 1987, 88, 89, and 1990.
Yeah.
Whenever he would tour the eastern half of North America. Mm-hmm. It was John Lee Hooker and the Kingsnakes. Well, he'd bring like some of his band from the Coast to Coast Blues band, like Kenny Baker was a saxophone player I got to be very good friends with. He used to live with me for a while. And Deacon Jones on the Hammond B3, or as Hooker would say, the Hammond B3, or 3B. He was a character. And Mike Osborne, who was his guitar player, like kind of like right-hand man. And so we would do that. It was a trip, you know. It was a once-in-a-lifetime experience. So
yeah, incredible.
Yeah.
You did that, when you say, up to like 90, and then I think did you play with him after the Kingsnakes, or like did you play with him, but was just like you, or was it always Kingsnakes?
No, just really as the Kingsnakes, yeah. And then he went, you know, he went to a different level, like after like 91, you know, with those hits that he had. You know, we were actually playing with him when that the Healer album came out.
Yeah, he's
on MTV and stuff, you know, and all this. So it was very cool.
Yeah.
And so then it was like we had another year of the Kingsnakes, I think, in 91. And then that was reaching its end. And then I got a call from Kim Simmons, from Savoy Brown, and asked if I would like to join that outfit. So that was I was having quite an experience back.
Yeah, that's awesome. So how long were you with Savoy Brown?
The better part of 5 years with Kim was like 1991 up until 1996.
Nice.
And we toured, you know, all North America and Scandinavia, Europe. It was a lot of traveling. Great experience.
Oh, incredible. Yeah, you guys were probably doing, a lot of shows a year, probably.
Yeah, man.
A year or something, yeah.
It was a trip, you know.
Awesome. Let's see, we want to move on to here. We're going to make a list. One of the things we're doing with this is I do a list of links about stuff that I can find and we can get to whatever. There's some Kingsnake stuff that is streaming. I wish there was more streaming stuff. Maybe I got to talk to Greg Spencer about and, you know, say, see more of it out there because, it's a streaming world now, and I know that it's not the best payday for the artists or the record companies and stuff, but it's how people get turned on to stuff, you know what I mean? So
yeah,
you might end up with more people paying for the live shows or donating money or buying your merch or maybe buying the albums and stuff anyways because they just want to support the thing or whatever, you know. But like,
yeah,
I don't even have a CD player anymore, and I haven't really in 10 years, you know. So, you know, Spotify, YouTube are like the main go-tos for me, and it's just, it's really cool because I can look at something so easily, or like for these, you know, we can do these podcasts and we can put it on the website, and I can have 20 links afterwards where somebody who's looking at this and you know, whether whatever level they're at as a fan, whether they're new or they've been a fan for 40 years, they can click, 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 and they can learn about stuff. They can, well, this is what John Lee Hooker sounds like. This is what this sounds like, you know, and they can really get to it. And I think that's sort of a magical time for us that we get to be able to do that. Like, I get that there was something to the passion of what it was decades ago where you had to seek it out and go chase it down, you know?
Yeah.
That certainly led to passionate fans, but there's, you know, it's a different time. And then there was also the fact that you didn't get to get turned on to everything, and some of it just was, you know, exposure. Maybe you didn't have when you went to the record store, you only have so much money in your pocket, and you're like,
exactly,
well, I can't
buy
everything that I'm sort of interested in, and maybe you chose what you knew you liked instead of going for something that you weren't certain of. And so it's a different era now, you know, where we can
absolutely
share this great stuff that's happened throughout the century, really. So give me a few must listen to blues albums and your blues, in your opinion.
Okay, like any of the early Muddy Waters, you know, that had that essential early Muddy Waters band that like electrified the Chicago blues thing, you know what I mean, with Little Walter.
Yeah.
So that's like the, you know, 1949, 50, 51, 52.
Mm-hmm.
And then actually Little Walter recorded with Muddy Waters because he was just such a big name and such a great harmonica player that they would have, even after Little Walter went on his own.
Yeah.
And any Little Walter stuff, you know, he left Muddy Waters and touring band in 1952. He had a number one hit with an instrumental called Juke that became a big hit, and then he had a bunch of hits through the early and mid and later 50s. He was like a big recording star, you know.
Yeah.
And just, he was just, in my opinion, head and shoulders above anybody that's ever drew a breath on the instrument, you know. He was phenomenal, and still to this day, you know. Let's see, who else? Obviously, John Lee Hooker. Big fan of John Lee Hooker. And like I say, that one album was really big with the Kinks. It's called Hooker and Heat.
Hooker and Heat.
You know, John Lee Hooker with Canned Heat. And it's called Hooker and Heat.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah,
I think it's like a double album.
Yep.
And some of the stuff is just John Lee Hooker in the studio himself with his electric guitar and beating his foot on a piece of wood, you know, that they had microphone. It is so powerful. It's like he's a force of nature, you know. It's how somebody can do that, you know, by themselves is just, that's a testament of, you know, blues power.
Sure.
That's just incredible. What else? So much, you know. Early Jay Giles band was a huge influence on me. Magic Dixon, you know, phenomenal harmonica player. And you know, their early albums are very Chicago blues influenced, and they had a high energy thing going, just incredible.
Yeah.
And
you went into something, and you were a Butterfield Blues Band fan as well.
Oh yeah, man! I remember the first time I bought that double album, Golden Butter. That's a really good one, and it's,
I don't know if I know that one. I was a big East-West fan.
The Golden Butter is two. I think it's a double album, and does that one live version on there that's of Driftin' and Driftin'.
Okay.
I remember hearing that for the first time, just shattered your brain. You know what I mean? If you're a harmonica player, it was just like unbelievable. But there's so many great players out there, you know, and the one thing that it's hard for people to understand is there's so many like brilliant blues harmonica players out there, you know, nowadays, and you know, in the more modern era, but everybody's like doing, or a lot of people are doing that Little Walter template, like, and it's so hard to imagine, like, to go back before Little Walter, and it was very different. You know, there was like Sonny Boy Williamson, one, John Lee Williamson, who was like the big Chicago blues guy, but it was very like more simplistic and countrified harmonica. And Little Walter came in and he took that, you know, electrified it with a bullet microphone and the amplification and the reverb that they would use in Chess Studios. And he just like incorporated it to be kind of part harmonica, part saxophone, and just because he had that brain, that musicality in his brain of listening to like jazz saxophone players. And so he would try to get that stuff out of the harmonica, and this crazy thing developed, which nowadays you hear people do it. It's like, oh yeah, I'm doing this, but like everybody's going off that template. You know, he was the genius that created that. It gets lost in the shuffle. You know, yeah. What I mean? Of how brilliant he was.
Yeah, I think maybe because he wasn't as known as a writer, or I think that he just didn't, his longevity wasn't there, and a lot, you know, I mean, right, his name isn't talked about as much, but I totally get what you're saying, that he, you know, was like a lightning bolt in that whole thing, that it's, you know, a lot of that stuff is, you can feel the rock and roll explosion coming up in it, but he's full of it. I mean it's like that excitement, he's got the same excitement that Little Richard was to bring a few years later. Exactly.
You know, they were all fans of Little Walter. I'll tell you right now. And like Elvis was a big fan of Little Walter. See, he was Little Walter at that time was a big recording star. He had a lot of hits up.
Yeah.
You know, My Babe, and instrumentals like Juke was a number one hit. But so he was, like you say, and he had this one song called Crazy Mixed Up World that talks about that. He talks about, I love to rock and roll. That's one of the lines in his song. That's like you say, it was just, the wave was just coming.
Yeah.
Then Chuck Berry showed up at Chess Studios and so on. And
yeah.
Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis and all the patriarchs of that crazy art form. But I'll tell you one interesting thing too, just to put Little Walter in perspective. A couple times, John Lee Hooker, when we were on the road, I remember one time waking up in the morning, there was a knock at the door, and somebody, I would think I was in the bathroom or something, and like, they're like, hey, Pete, John's at the door. I'm like, John who? You know, like, Hooker's at the door. So I, you know, wash my face up, brush my teeth, get up, go out, and he's like, he's all dressed in his, you know, three-piece suit and tie and gangster hat and shades. And he's like, oh yeah, I was gonna take you out to breakfast. I want to go over to, geez, kidding me? Can't refuse breakfast with John Lee Hooker, right? So we went, and he did that a couple times, which, again, you never forget things like that. But so we were talking, he was saying, he's going, yeah, you know, talking about being on the road. He said, I'm enjoying, you know, playing with you guys and stuff. This is fun. He goes, said, you remind me a lot of the late, great Little Walter, you know, with the harmonica. So I was like, wow, thank you so much, you know. But he said, too, he goes, you know, I was good friends with Little Walter. And I knew him, long time. And he goes, everybody knows how great a harmonica player Little Walter was, you know, and everybody knows about that. That's well documented. But he goes, I'll tell you, he said, he was my favorite blues singer. So that puts a little perspective on things too. When you have somebody love the magnification of John Lee Hooker, you know, saying that a Little Walter was his favorite blues singer.
Yeah.
It's a lot of perspective on Little Walter, you know, he's really something.
Yeah, that's awesome. Good stuff. Yeah, we'll have a nice little selection of stuff for people to check.
Yeah, man.
I love that. Definitely Little Walter deserves every bit of love and attention that we can throw that direction. What about any current artists? Blues or blues related or anything that you happen to like?
You know, I'm not so hip to like the newer stuff. You know, I should be, Been busy, you know, like teaching special education and so on. But I always go back and listen and stuff, but I'm not as in tune, you know, by not being out on the road and stuff.
Yeah.
I plan on hopefully, like, when I get down, you know, getting nearer to, like, retirement from that gig, I'm going to try to get, you know, back and put my energy back into music, you know. It's my first love, mm-hmm. you know, and hopefully get a little more in tune with that kind of stuff. And but there's, man, that's the thing, that'll never go away, you know. Like Hooker used to say, blues have been here ever since, like, Adam and Eve.
Yeah.
Since there was a man and a woman, you know.
Yeah.
And that's really the fundamentals of it, because it's all about, you know, that experience. And it's, you know, about the, like, you know, the trials and tribulations in life, but it's also about the you know, joys and happiness, you know. It's got all that stuff in it. It's not just the sad stuff, which is cool. And I remember playing when I was back with Otis Lee when I was young. He used to say, you know, at the live gigs, or he would say it off stage too, he'd say, you know, the blues takes the blues away. So in other words, if you go, you know, you got something going on in your life, you know, in a relationship or whatever it is, you lost your job kind of thing, and you're feeling down and so on. If you go and, you know, experience a real, you know, real blues, and you go through all those highs and lows, a good blues artist will take you, you know, through, you know, all the different experiences, life experiences, then you've kind of, like, exercise the demons, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
If you go through it. So in other words, like, the blues will take the blues away. I always like that line.
Yeah.
It's like therapy.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. There's a great thing about it. It's like one of those things where I think in general, when a lot of music is working in its best, it's the sort of lines between the artist and the audience become blurred or meshed, you know, and that it's not, you know, that there's a commonality or whatever, and that human commonality, you know.
And that's the sad thing about this time we're in now, like you say, you know, that you can't do that live music thing.
And
it's live music is different, you know, like you say, that's the experience.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, with any kind of music, but especially with blues oriented music, it's, you got to experience that experience, you know.
Definitely. So you mentioned that you're in an educator now, and so have you has music been a part of did you do any music education? Has that been a part of your career?
I haven't, but I used to, like, you know, way back, I remember going into schools a little bit, like, for my niece when she was really young, I would play it in their class and talk about blues and that kind of thing. And hopefully that's something that, you know, they would remember, like, that was, like, second grade, I think, for her. And, and I remember over the years, different people say, oh yeah, you came into our classroom, and, you know, little things like that. But I know they have different programs and so on. And I would like to, you know, maybe in the future too, try to do something like that.
Yeah, very cool. I mean, so I'm not sure how aware you are of what we got going on. Maybe you are, but for everybody else who's listening as well. So, you know, besides putting on the festival, Blues Fest organization, we have a variety of different education initiatives that we're pursuing and trying to expand on. One is we do the KJ James Scholarship. And we award 3 scholarships annually in that. And we've had some great winners, Dunham Hall and Neil Manat, who have been awarded that in recent years. But I will say that, you know, one of the reasons that we're really trying to continue to push it is because we don't get enough applicants, you know, and it's not even just like, is it people who already know the blues? It's that, I don't know, kids are, whether they're not playing the instruments or they're not playing, you know, analog instruments or whatever you want to call it. You know, I don't know, we work hard to try to get the word out. And so, but it's just, you'd think the amount of applicants would be more. So we have been expanding our conversation, and we got into, it's like, well, we're going to have to get into the schools and start educating people at a younger age. So then a couple of years ago, a few years ago, we started doing, well, the other thing we've been doing, we have had a student band play at the festival for years.
That's and so great.
That was a little bit hard getting people rounded up for it, you know, and again, there's, you know, you find these people who, kids who've got, you know, lucky for them, they've got great parents, and their parents got them music lessons and bought them instruments and all that stuff, and that's really great for them, and certainly don't ever want to take away anybody from that situation because you can't beat great parents, but, you know, it's we're always in this conversation about how do we reach these, how do we reach other young people, and how do we try to provide opportunities for them to get exposed to stuff or to become a player, you know, if they don't have all the you know, same benefits there that some other kids have got or whatever, you know? Absolutely. So we have this Blues in Schools program that we've been doing the past couple of years, and it's really just getting rolling, but it's the idea of, you know, going into the schools, and I think we're hitting fourth, fifth grade, whatever is what we're starting about at about.
Right.
And getting that going, and more, it was just, the sad thing here is it was just starting to get going, and then we'd had a good year with it last year, and then the pandemic stuff has totally thrown things off base, and
I'll tell you, man.
You know, now we can't have people going into the schools, and it's they don't ever know what their schedule is going to be, and the online time they have is obviously, you know, it's, the world is chaos. It's just not
a great time
to be introducing new stuff. But you know, we're trying to keep pursuing it and figure out every angle we can hit it from, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah. I think the one good thing that maybe will come of this is that, you know, people will really appreciate when, like you say, they get to go experience a live gig.
Yeah.
You know, it's like something maybe we almost took for granted. A lot of things in life we probably took for granted, that hopefully this is one thing that you can get from that, is to, you know, you're down to the fundamentals of who are you spending the pandemic with, you know, appreciate, you know, count your blessings, man.
Yeah.
Because it could be worse, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, yeah, well, we should talk more about education stuff, you know, throughout time here or whatever. And as
absolutely.
You know, we can get you involved. And we'd love it if you
love it
and in some way. And we got some different ideas about getting into, you know, maybe drafting some students that we see are interested in, getting some mentorships and stuff set up with them so that we can start to develop them from that kid thing to the, you know, to the, you know, through their teen years and stuff like that. Because, you know, it, I mean, as you know, it's, you know, having that as a, you know, first off, having mentorship, but having something, finding something that you can be passionate about is a big, a big part of it, you know?
Yeah.
Well, awesome. This has been great. You know, I really appreciate you coming on with us today. What do you got going on? Do you have anything musically coming up if we do get out of this, or?
Not, you know, I'm just waiting for, because we still got a ways to go.
We got a ways to go, right?
But hopefully we're seeing you starting around the corner and see the light at the end of the tunnel with the vaccines and so on.
Yeah.
If it's anything like 2020, let's hope it's not a train coming at us.
I don't know. I mean, I want to be optimistic, and, you know, certainly we're making plans for the festival and everything to, you know, to go, should, you know, the world be in the place that it's time for us to go, and then we're going to go this year. But at the same time, you know, I don't know, right now, here we are as we sit, you know, at the end of the year here, it's pretty tough to really call it one way or the other right now. And, you know,
definitely.
You know, as it is now, we got all our plans in place to, you know, to go in June and have it. And maybe, you know, by the time 3 months from now, things will look much rosier than they are, you know, at the moment.
Just
to keep hoping and praying on that. But
amen.
Yeah, well, very good. So thank you a bunch for taking the time to chat with us today. I love hearing all your great stories. I'd like to remind everybody listening that this podcast is brought to you by the New York State Blues Festival, one of the largest free blues events in the country. Please mark your calendars for June 24th through 26th, 2021 for our anticipated return to Clinton Square in downtown Syracuse. For all details and information about the event, including how you can become a supporter of our organization for the festival and all that great educational stuff we're doing, please visit our website at nysbluesfest.com. Thanks again, Pete. Thank you all for tuning in to episode 2 of Somebody's Blues. Be good, dig the music, and spread the love. Peace.
Blues power.
Blues power.